It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll talk to a local teacher and author about his quest to share the history and current news from Armenia.
But he fought them off long enough for my grandmother and her three teen daughters to escape into the woods. Unfortunately, no one would help an Armenian because it would be a death penalty.
Also, you'll hear from the local management team at the San Luis Obispo Tribune.
The heyday for the industry was in the early 2000s. Everything was like at its peak. The internet was coming up and it was providing us with new resources and abilities to do things. And, you know, then the recession hit.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 19th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. California's underwater kelp forests are in trouble. A combination of climate change and hungry purple sea urchins have decimated these vital forests. But the Central Coast has a kelp forest guardian, sea otters. As KAZU's Erica Mahoney reports, new research is highlighting their role.
Sea otters are adorable. They have big eyes, wispy whiskers, and dense fur coats. Even their sounds are cute, as captured by the Monterey Bay Aquarium. But beyond all that cuteness, sea otters are important to the Monterey Bay's ecosystem, notably defending kelp forests, which are home to over 800 different animal species, forests that are already in bad shape. Standing near a beach on Cannery Row in Monterey, Josh Smith, a PhD candidate at UC Santa Cruz, describes what the kelp forest here looked like just a decade ago.
The canopy would have spread out across this entire little bay right here that we're in. And so right now what we're seeing is a very patchy kelp forest.
That motivated him to research the role sea otters play in the complex story of disappearing kelp. The story begins around 2013. That's when the number of purple sea urchins skyrocketed after a disease wiped out one of their main predators. Urchins devour kelp. The declining forest was further weakened by warming waters, a symptom of climate change. Kelp needs cold water to survive. The result? Northern California lost 95% of its kelp forest in under a decade. The Monterey Bay area fared better, only losing around 60%.
One thing that our study has shown is that having predators like the sea otter are really important in helping to buffer this ecosystem from change.
The PhD candidate says sea otters are slowing the decline of the local kelp forest by eating up urchins. In fact, three times as many as they used to. To collect data, Smith spent about 300 hours underwater along the Monterey Peninsula. He also worked with scientists from the Monterey Bay Aquarium and the U.S. Geological Survey, who used telescopes and rangefinders to record what sea otters were eating and where.
One thing that's great about studying sea otters is they consume their prey at the surface. So we can watch an otter dive down, and we can record where it came up and what it came up with.
The team's findings were recently published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They found that otters ignore urchin barrens, areas where urchins have overgrazed kelp to the bare seafloor. The purple creatures there are starving, often called zombie urchins. Instead, the otters focus on foraging the healthy ones in the remaining patches of kelp.
Because sea otters are targeting urchins in these forests, they're helping to maintain the remnant patches of kelp forest that we actually have from overgrazing by sea urchins.
Otters live between Santa Barbara and just north of Santa Cruz. Further north from otter territory, urchins have no predators. And that's possibly why the kelp forest decline is more severe in Northern California. Tristan McHugh, who works for the Nature Conservancy, is trying to find solutions.
In Northern California, we don't have otters, we don't have lobsters, we don't have sheephead, we don't have sunflower stars. That really puts the pressure currently on humans to fill the role of that top predator.
The Nature Conservancy is exploring several innovative ideas, including urchin trapping, to pull the spiny creatures out of the water. It's also launching an experimental kelp farm. The pilot project is scheduled to begin this spring in Humboldt Bay. As for the Monterey Bay, sea otters keep urchins with an insatiable taste for kelp in check, something Dane Durand, who manages the Aquarius Dive Shop in Monterey, definitely appreciates. As he fills up scuba tanks, he says the kelp forest draws people from all over the world.
So we get people from England and all over Europe. I just had somebody from Iceland last week. The kelp forest is something extremely special here.
From supporting the local economy to removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Luckily, the local kelp forest has guardians. Guardians that play a larger role than just looking and sounding cute.
That was KAZU's Erica Mahoney reporting. Temperatures are on the rise, wildflowers are in bloom, and many are feeling pulled to the great outdoors. Among them is Lee Bernacki, the author of the new guidebook, Sequoia and Kings Canyon, Hiking, Camping, Waterfalls, and Big Trees. She spoke with KVPR's Kathleen Schock about some of the best off-the-beaten-path places to visit in the parks.
I was a naturalist ranger in Lodgepole right out of college, and I tried to get to know the park as well as I could, like hiking and backpacking every weekend and after work, trying to hike every trail in the giant forest. There's over 50 miles of trail just right in there. And I was like a little Pac-Man going around trying to see everything. But since then, I've gotten to go back with my family, and I've realized like the importance of history and natural history and geology, and really trying to like bring this story together. So even though it's been a long time coming, this book is really a love letter to my fellow Valley residents, because I just want us all to get out there and experience the healing and beauty and restorative qualities of Sequoia and Kings Canyon.
You know, you obviously have a tremendous passion for public lands. What is it that draws you to those spaces?
Yeah, I think public lands are the best idea we've ever had. To me, they mean freedom. They mean escape from the trappings of modern life. They mean an opportunity to live in your animal body and to feel and breathe and enjoy life. I feel like it's what we're meant to do. And I think that public lands are unique in that they're for everyone. Sequoia and Kings Canyon is our national park.
You know, as I was doing my research for this conversation, I was reminded of a day hike I did in Sequoia a while back. And my husband and I got to talking with a couple on the trail who were visiting from back east. And they were like, "You're so lucky to have this in your backyard." And you know, it made me realize how much I think people in the Valley take Sequoia Kings Canyon for granted. And I don't know if that's a function of sort of being in Yosemite's shadow. What are your thoughts about that?
Oh, I love this question. I feel like we are so lucky to live at the gateway to the mountains and to receive so much as we do from the mountains. I mean, economically, the contributions of all the tourism every night in a hotel, every meal, every stop at a gas station and fruit stand, that adds up. But people really do come from all over the world to experience our home, our mountains. I also think of the forest as the Valley's lungs. The mountains are the Valley's water source, and the parks are a welcome reprieve from everything else that we're surrounded by. And that's like the main reason I wrote the book, was for the choice between an afternoon in a strip mall or at the movies, which I go to those too. You can go to the mountains and have an entire day with your whole family for the same price. But really, I think that having Sequoia and Kings Canyon should be like a huge sense of pride for us. We get to live right next to the largest living beings on Earth, and we should take pride in our home and protect it.
Well, okay, let's get into it. I want to hear, what are your recommendations for places that are maybe a little bit off the beaten path that you would recommend people check out?
Well, if you haven't tried backpacking before, if you're like a little nervous, you can join up with the Sequoia Conservancy and spend the night out there. That's when I feel like my soul is most alive, is when everything I need is on my back and I'm just walking out there. There's tons of trails, and it's the place where I did my first solo backpacking. It's just a very hospitable place where you have to be a little careful, but I would recommend doing a backpack if you haven't tried it, or joining up with some of the groups that are exploring out there if you're a little nervous to try. But if you want to get away from the crowds, there are so many wonderful places that are actually right next to some of the most crowded places. You go to the General Grant Tree, which is the second largest. And it's a total zoo, and there's a bunch of buses, and it's kind of noisy, but you still get that like connection with the tree. Well, just 200 yards away from the General Grant start of the trail is the North Grove, and you won't see anyone else in there. Same with the General Sherman. I recommend going into Circle Meadow, which is only a couple miles away from the main attraction in a giant forest. And so you can get to the main attraction, but then if you just go a little bit farther, you will experience some solitude, maybe see like sunlight glinting through the forest onto an entire bed of lupin by yourself, which has happened to me. The other thing is, people always think of Morro Rock, their shirts. Everyone's like, I got to climb that one granite dome. That's the one you can see. I got to get up there. And yes, it is an experience in and of itself, but it's also like very crowded, especially on a weekend in the summer. So there's all these wonderful other granite knobs that are sticking up where you can get a great view. I would recommend Little Baldy.
Hoping you were going to say that. That's one of my favorites.
Oh my gosh, I know. It's the best. Little Baldy is great for a little bit longer of a hike. Big Baldy is kind of central and actually really flat for what view you get. And when I'm hiking with my kid in my backpack, I take her up to Buena Vista Peak because it's just short and quick and a great view. And you can look down onto Redwood Mountain Grove, which leads me to like the one hidden gem that's not that hidden. It's often crowded down there, like not crowded. Relatively, not Yosemite crowded. This is like 20 cars crowded, but a lot of people don't go into Redwood Mountain Grove. And it is like such a sacred little space, especially this time of year. So if you can get out in the next 2 months and brave your way down the one lane road, it is special. Have you been there?
I have, and it is definitely worth that drive down that windy road.
Yeah.
So we are in the spring season. Where would you recommend people go right now?
We are so privileged to have an abundance of wildflowers, so much variety. Thousands of species live in the parks, but right now they're going off in the foothills. So I would check out Marble Falls or get into the Middle Fork because there's no cars in that entire canyon. It's like a really wilderness area with just a few miles of walk along a beautiful river. So Marble Falls and the Middle Fork River is where I'd go this weekend if I could.
This has been such a delight. I've been talking with Lee Bernacki, the author of Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park, Hiking, Camping, Waterfalls, and Big Trees. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. Happy trails.
That was KVPR's Kathleen Schock. Local teacher and author Bruce Bedrigian launches a new website this week and an updated version of his novel, Armenia's Fingerprint. This coincides with the 106th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, which occurred on April 24, 1915.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate you having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got to the West Coast and started to write the book, Armenia's Fingerprint?
I was 19 when I had dropped out of school and was butting heads with my Armenian father and wasn't sure what I was going to do. And after lifeguarding one summer, I went out on, got a ride to the freeway, a mass turnpike by my father with a little sign that said West. And I had seen some pictures of Big Sur and I was going to hitchhike to Big Sur. I wanted to see something new. I had to go out and get away and find myself. And so that started it. And 3 weeks later, I ended up in California, looking at the Pacific Ocean for the first time, and that started everything. I found out here that, of all places, I ended up in Cayucas, California, and took on a job driving a school bus, and later went to school, driving that school bus into the parking lot, and working around the clock. I'd do my run in the morning and the afternoon, and then I would go to school during the day, and eventually got my teaching credential and started teaching.
What was the trigger for you to think about writing a novel? How did that come about?
Well, as I became older, I started to reflect back on what I learned and the stories I had heard about my Armenian heritage. I never really quite understood it until I started to hear things and do research, and I started reading about it. And the more I read, the more intrigued I became. And it just seemed to me that I needed to know more this side of my ancestry. It explained so much about my father and why he did the things he did, and why he worked three jobs nonstop, around the clock, graveyard shifts, trying to feed five kids, growing up in a three-decker and trying to break into the lower middle class. And that Armenia history and my grandparents, it was just an itch in my heart I couldn't scratch, and I needed to go ahead and find out more. And the deeper I dug, the more fascinating I was with the past.
The theme and what's in the book is of huge importance, because my own self, growing up in Fresno and knowing many Armenian kids, my schoolmates, and then going to their homes or church events, you learned bit by bit about how they got to the West Coast. And they were very happy to be there, but the whole journey, if you want to call it that, started in some of the worst Holocaust genocidal conditions ever. And I'm pretty sure that most people in the world don't know even what we're talking about.
Right. I have to give credit to my wife, because she supported me on this endeavor. And the research took years and years until I turned 60. And I was working three jobs, and I had become my dad, and I was too busy to actually write this novel. I had done the research. I had met the descendants. They had told me their Armenian stories of their ancestors. I had them. But then suddenly I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And my career came to a halt. It ended my full-time teaching career. And in the recovery that was more than a year long, I needed to do something with my mind. And that's when I began to write. And then years later, after writing and rewriting, I wanted to know more. And again, my wife supported me, and we flew 13,000 miles to Armenia for the 104th memorial anniversary of the genocide. And if it's okay, I'd like to share piece that I wrote concerning my arrival in Armenia. I think it explains why I wrote the novel.
Please do.
Hopefully, this novel will help people understand what happened to an historic nation of proud Armenians. It will also champion those who miraculously survived the horror of a heart-wrenching Holocaust, despite despicable and inhumane efforts to annihilate and destroy all Armenians and all remnants of their ancient culture. Clearly, that attempted genocide failed. We, the descendants, are still here. Armenians of all types, colors, mixtures, hybrids, they carry on our lineage with sincere respect for those who saved us, for those who died for us, and for those who, risking everything, finally found the freedom they earned and we enjoy. That point hit home the moment I arrived in Armenia in April 2019. I was waiting in line to have my passport stamped, allowing me entrance into my grandparents' homeland. The spiritual significance of the moment was not lost on me. As I looked ahead, there was a young man, perhaps 25 years of age. He looked bored. His smooth olive-colored skin, dark hair, deep brown eyes left little doubt that he was Armenian. In his prime, handsome as could be in his khaki, neatly ironed uniform with his shiny officer's badge that complemented his good looks and seriousness. When my turn came, I approached him and handed him my passport. He hardly looked up at me, and he perused the passport before routinely stating, "What is your business and purpose for coming to Armenia?" He didn't look up until I responded, "Purpose? My purpose is to research my grandmother and grandfather's escape and survival of the Armenian Genocide in 1915. The serious young man stopped, turning the pages of the little black book, and looked directly at me, no smile. Then he looked again at my passport, finding my surname, Badrigian. Bang! He stamped my passport. Is this your first time to Armenia? Yes, it is, I replied. Unexpectedly, he flashed a pearl-white smile, handed me my passport, looked me directly in the eye, and said, "Welcome home, sir." That set the tone for what was to come. And that's really when my Armenian education began.
Could you sort of set the stage for the novel itself and what it's about?
It's historical fiction because I had to make some changes because I wanted to have it read like a story. And it sounds like it's true because mostly it is all true. And my students, they read it. It's a page turner. They can't put it down and they ask great questions. But in reality, my grandmother's first husband was killed by the Turks, but he fought them off long enough for my grandmother and her three teen daughters to escape into the woods. Unfortunately, no one would help an Armenian because it would be a death penalty. And she had to watch her three daughters starve to death. And she was just about dead herself when my grandfather, who was fleeing and headed probably towards Musadah in the Mediterranean Sea, came by and said, "You will not die today," and helped her and nursed her somewhat back to health. And that began the harrowing tale. And ultimately, they found passage to Ellis Island. And after passing the mental and physical tests, the first thing they did was find a priest to marry them. And long story short, my grandmother went on and had three more children. She had two more daughters, Mary and Elizabeth, and had her first baby boy. She named him Simon Joseph, and that was my dad. And then he went on to have five children, and I was the oldest.
I would like to remind everybody that this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Bruce Badrigian, adjunct professor of English at Cuesta College and author of a gripping historical novel out in a new edition, Armenia's Fingerprint. Why do you think the Armenian genocide is so important on a historical and global scale? What lessons does it offer us today?
The Armenian genocide was actually the first modern genocide. So that was one of the reasons the rest of the world, I mean, there were witnesses. There were reports coming back to France and England and the United States. But frankly, they could not believe what was happening and they weren't sure. And so by the end of World War I, which a lot of countries were busy with their own problems during that time, and one genocide, the Armenian genocide, led into the Jewish Holocaust. And genocides are still occurring today. We see with the Rohingyas and the Uyghurs. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is until we face up to it and put a stop to it, it's going to continue.
I know that Hitler was quoted as saying that if his final solution was going to survive, it might ride on the example of the Armenian genocide, which took place with almost unrecognized and certainly unaided by the world powers at the time.
You're absolutely right. And that's why he thought he could get away with it. Here's just a real short piece. Those who stood by and passively watched the genocide in action were faced with more dilemmas, such as too many destitute Armenians to help. It's too dangerous to help them. What if we get caught? Will we ever be forgiven if we simply look the other way? So it was for mere individuals. So it was for entire nations.
We're approaching the 106th anniversary of the 1915 genocide, sort of the Turks' final solution, if I can use that term. Isn't it a fact that many nations of the world have recognized this officially? I think even the Catholic Church has, but our government in the United States has not.
Yes, and I'm hopeful, Brian, that President Biden is going to be the one. Many Armenians believed that President Obama was going to be the one, because when he was a senator, he said he would call it a genocide, because that's what it was. It's just irrefutable evidence and eyewitnesses. But when he, yeah, but when he came in, that all changed, and people know why. We have Turkey as a supposed ally of ours. We have military bases in Turkey. But now I'm seeing Biden start, I think he's seeing the writing on the wall, and he's moving parts of those bases over to Greece, where we also have bases. And we've fought beside the Greeks before. They reflect our morals and our values much more than Turkey does. And Turkey seems to be cozying up more and more with Russia. So it's interesting. And then the war with Azerbaijan and Armenia, that recent war, some say it's over, but it's not over. It's a ceasefire right now. But again, when Armenia went to war with Azerbaijan, Turkey jumped in right away, seeing an opportunity to kill more Armenians and lucratively make a tie between Turkey and Azerbaijan. And then Russia came in, brokered this ceasefire. And again, the winners were Russia, Azerbaijan, and Turkey. And Armenia, little landlocked nation, gets the short end of the stick once again. When President Wilson was there, and they were, the Allied powers were dividing up that area after World War I, President Wilson had Armenia. It was huge. It was the whole eastern part of Turkey belonged to Armenia. And Wilson said, yes, that's Armenia land. Mount Ararat's there. That belongs to the Armenians. And they're going to have this port on the Black Sea. That's all going to be Armenia. But when they started divvying it up, there weren't enough Armenians there to speak up, and Turkey ended up with the land. And that goes back to how devious Turkey was, because the annual celebration, the memorial, is April 24th coming up. And the reason that date is so important, 1915, that's when Turkey went ahead with a nefarious plan, and they rounded up all of the clergy, the politicians, all of the great leaders, the doctors, the lawyers, the teachers, the professors, everybody that was possibly would lead the Armenian country, and then killed them all on that day.
Right. They were invited to like a meeting, a big summit conference, I think,
to broker a peace.
Right.
And it was all a ruse, and they were all murdered, decapitated, and put on display.
How can average people, maybe somewhat uninformed, what can they do to learn more? And we do want to mention your website, which is www.armeniasfingerprint.com. It's a blog, and people can learn more and participate, and also more about your book. But what can average people do to get better informed and make a difference?
Well, I'm hoping that people will go to my website, armeniasfingerprint.com, because I'm going to keep updating that. And there's a place where they can sign up, and I'm going to put out a newsletter, and they can join, and I will send them the newsletter. I mean, I read the Greek paper, I read the Armenian paper, and I want to be the voice for what's going on in that area of the world currently. And that way get more people involved so they know what is going on there. They'll be able to contact me. They can read the articles that are posted there. I try and keep them current and interesting. There's articles about Armenian Americans that people don't even know about. The Pentagon Papers would not have happened if it wasn't for Ben Bagdikian, who was an Armenian who carried those papers at great risk to himself. So there's so many stories like that where Armenians were involved, but they go unrecognized. And so hopefully I can go ahead and inform the Armenian populace concerning that. I'm hoping to also do presentations, speak to groups, and the website is going to be the linchpin for that.
I want to let everybody know this has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Bruce Badrigian, adjunct professor of English at Cuesta College and author of the new edition of Armenia's Fingerprint, celebrating also the 106th anniversary of the start of the Armenian genocide. And thank you so much, Bruce.
Working Lunch is a Facebook Live program initially started by the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce to help keep us connected during the pandemic. Each week, Executive Director Jim D'Antona has a conversation with a member of the community.
Today, we'll be sitting down with Joe Tirica and Ray Reardon, two of the key leaders at the Tribune. For nearly three decades, Joe Tirica has worked in various roles at the Tribune, including as copy editor, designer, writer of the Joetopia column, and for the past few years, he's been holding down the fort as editor. Joe began his career at the Tribune in 1991 as an intern while he was a student at Cal Poly. After graduating with a double major in journalism and English, he was hired full-time as a copy editor. In his time with the Tribune, Joe has earned accolades including the Scripps Howard Company-wide Annual Award for Best Headline Writing, three California News Publishers Association Awards for Column Writing, and more than 25 Society for News Design Awards as the presentation editor overseeing the production of the newspaper in his time as editor. In his time as editor, the Tribune has been named as the best news organization in its circulation category by the California News Publishers Association 2 years in a row. He's being joined today by Ray Reardon. After a successful career in the beverage industry, Ray developed and launched a magazine specifically for the registered nursing profession, which grew to be the largest nursing publication in the U.S. with Ray as the publisher. Ray came to the Tribune as their key account manager and now serves as director of sales. Today, I'm excited to talk with Joe and Ray about modern expectations for journalistic excellence, the role of local news in a healthy community, and getting to know the people behind the paper you trust. Joe and Ray, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Jim.
Good to have you here. And so as we sit down to lunch, first and foremost, Joe, where are you zooming in from today?
So I'm at home in Atascadero, sitting in a cluttered office that doubles as a music studio.
Sounds like the modern work office environment.
Yeah.
Ray, how about you?
Boy, I feel like I've got my twin, okay, because I'm in my studio, okay, and doubles as my office. And funny that Joe and I, with his drums and my guitar, we've never played together, but we're gonna fix it.
We have guitars and drums. Now we just need a lead singer. Joe, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the editor of the Tribune does on a typical day, or maybe even in an atypical week like we might be having.
I mean, now it's like, you know, wake up in the room on the other side of this wall, and, you know, come in here, and then just, you know, get connected to everything. So basically they're catching up in the morning to see what's happened overnight. You know, is there anything we have to jump on first thing? You know, we work via Slack a lot to communicate with the staff now. So I'll check in with them first and just see, you know, what everybody's doing. So they'll tell me like, I got this thing happening, or we're doing this, I'm gonna be here. And we'll look at the stuff that we had sort of post overnight. We schedule stories to post in the morning so that the website has new content. And then we'll sort of go after the first things, like, is there something we have to do? And then from there, it's like, you know, kind of just a sprint through the day. Lots of things happening. We only have two editors really on our staff, me and Sarah Lynn. And so she'll usually track like the breaking news stuff, and I'll have like various things I have to do. So like meetings, calls. We're part of a regional team in California. We're one of five McClatchy newspapers. So we'll have like, you know, calls with the region, and we'll check in, see what Sacramento is doing. You know, Fresno has stories that we might want to look at. So we share that kind of information. And then we just go through the day in the middle of the day, we have our print deadline is at 2 p.m. So what we do is we're balancing immediate response, like online digital story, you know, posting with the print edition of the paper. So we have to like try to get stuff up really quickly and do all that. And then at some point in that middle of the day, we sort of balance these two things and really plan the paper out and make sure we have that all set so that we can share that plan with the team.
I'm going to get my dog now. Okay.
Joe, I think what you're talking about, I want to dig into in a moment, because that really is an interesting piece. That newspaper, obviously businesses change. It's more, you know, there's lots of different mediums that you're having to tackle. But Ray, maybe talk a little bit for us about how does your role as director of sales interact with the news side of the house? I know there's a perception of a rivalry of sorts between news and the sales side of the newspaper business. Has that changed at all in the last few years?
I think that rivalry may not be the right word. I think that any quality journalistic company is going to, you know, have a separation of church and state. Okay, so basically what happens is that you know, it's completely inappropriate for somebody on the sales side to recommend a story to an editor. Okay, I mean, basically it has to be a separation of, you know, we're not going to take what a customer is going to do from an advertising standpoint and hope that that influences a story, you know, in our editorial team. What we will do, though, is that, you know, as Joe said, I mean, I love the fact that you both think I'm out there. Okay. But as I'm out in the street and, you know, and our sales staff is in the street, you know, sometimes we hear things that, you know, that they may not hear. So we have a very, very specific, you know, path to editorial, and it has nothing to do with trying to influence the editorial. It's just that if we hear something, you know, I have, you know, the opportunity to, you know, talk to Joe or talk to, you know, our writers, sometimes even just our photographers. If I know from my experience that this might be something, we send it over, but very, very clear when I'm talking to a client that, you know, that I'm not that guy. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, I handle the advertising, the marketing side of it. They know far better than I ever would whether it had, you know, an editorial hook, whether it had legs. Okay. And it's just something that, you know, it's a blessing for me because, you know, I do have that experience in the past to know where that line is. We're also very blessed that anybody that works for us is going to learn where that line is. And, you know, they don't have to be taught by Joe because it's going to come from me. You know, we're just not going to cross that line on any circumstance.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. The Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Joe Tirica and Ray Reardon of the San Luis Obispo Tribune.
Obviously, you both have a bit of experience in the industry. Maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the most significant ways that things have evolved since you first started, or maybe even over the last 12 months for COVID. Joe, do you give us a few thoughts on that?
So I've like been at the Tribune since full-time since 93, like you said. So that's like, you know, 28 years now. And it really was an arc of a time of change. Basically I went from like producing the newspaper as an afternoon paper alone, just the paper, you know, pre-digital, you know, we would type on these old computers and we'd send out like print the things and we'd paste up, you know, the paper, all everything like that. So the original way it was done for many decades, you know, it was done that way. Through starting with that, going through to like desktop publishing. So pagination occurred and we got to shift off that. Then the internet sort of, you know, became big, and then the website became big, and then the emphasis started to shift. And all through that period, it was like, learn a new thing, you know, give up something here, you know, transition, become more efficient. You know, we went through sort of what I would call the heyday from probably for the industry was in the early 2000s when everything was like at its peak, but the internet was coming up and it was, you know, providing us with new resources and abilities to do things. And, you know, then the recession hit after that. And it's been like, since that time in the last decade, it's been a real like struggle of reimagining and figuring out what the future is going to be like.
Sure. And Ray, just thinking about that and from your time in publishing, you know, from what you see happening, have you seen a lot of that same transition from your work in sales and advertising?
It used to be a fairly easy job for a sales rep. Okay. As Joe said, you know, in the heyday, you know, that the newspaper either did go or had the perception that it went to everybody. Okay. So, I mean, so that was the first thing. And, you know, we didn't have, you know, the digital aspect of it. If somebody ran an ad in the publication, they got results. It was a money machine. I mean, it really was. I mean, there's, you know, no getting around it. And I was not with the Tribune at that time. I was my own company, right? So we had, you know, double digit growth year after year after year. You know, it was a great, wonderful experience. The thing that happens though is that, you know, when the recession hit, exactly what Joe was saying is that, you know, that forced a necessary change in the industry, and it made us all better actually. Okay. Because, you know, even though I wasn't with the Tribune, you know, we still went through the contraction. We still went through having to make, you know, necessary changes, you know, the blessing for me is that, you know, that I lived in Silicon Valley during the technological boom and I owned the domain nurse.com. Can't go wrong. Okay. So, I mean, it was relatively good for us at that time. Now, what we see though, is that, there's just so many different ways to, you know, to reach the public and give them the information. The big important thing is making sure that the information we provide is quality. And as long as Joe's doing his job, which he does great, no matter what the different modalities that we're dealing with, it makes our job easy. If editorial is not good and content isn't quality, nothing else happens from a sales perspective.
I'd love to talk a little bit about what you see as the most important thing you do at the Tribune. You know, what is your ultimate mission? As media and news consumption has changed, has delivering on that mission evolved, Joe?
The method of delivery has evolved, you know, and changed. The mission has not changed. In fact, it's more important now than probably it's ever been. And the mission is, you know, informing the public and, you know, knowing that we have basically, in defense of our democracy, that we have, you know, a citizenry that has truthful, honest, reliable information about the things that are important to them in their lives. And that can range from, you know, what's happening at City Hall and holding, you know, public officials accountable to, you know, what things are changing in their daily lives. Like what's happening to the corner store, you know, like what businesses are coming to your community. People care a lot about that. It's very important. And we have the ability now to tell these kinds of stories faster and in new ways with, you know, video and tools we didn't have before. We were just a print paper. But we also have competition from a lot of other sources. You know, anybody can be a publisher now. And, you know, some of them you can rely on and they're good. And a lot of others are just spreading rumors or they're just making trouble. And so it's really tough when you see the contraction in the industry when, you know, in an industry that's so important to a core facet of this country that we are still trying to look out for those priorities. And it's harder than it's ever been. It's more important than it's ever been. And we're trying to get, you know, more creative as we go.
And maybe you could talk real quickly about, Joe, about when it comes to deciding what makes the cut, what is printed versus digital or not covered at all. What are some of the major factors you consider there?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that is like what we talk about with audience, you know, like what is the audience need or want? So as far as in what goes in the paper or on the website, we basically use most, you know, of what we do, what we would put on the website will appear in the paper. With the size of the staff now, we need kind of everything that they're producing, you know, to go to fill the paper. And because we want the paper to be as local as possible. That's my goal. My goal is like a local front page. I would rather not have to rely on, you know, the wire services. So in terms of like what we're doing there, we're trying to like, you know, get everything into both locations and need it all there. But there are things that we just can't do that we used to do. You know, we used to have space in the paper and resources on the staff to cover more smaller issues. Like we would have, you know, we'd accept things from people and we would publish the little, you know, the little announcements, the, you know, the awards, the kind of like refrigerator journalism, you might call it, the thing you would, you know, cut out and put on the fridge. We just can't do those things. We really have to emphasize putting our resources in the highest value locations.
And Ray, this sounds like a multimedia company, right? You're not, you have a print, you have a digital, you have a footprint, you have an app, right? Can you tell me a little bit about your audience?
You know, back in the day, everybody, or at least the perceived everybody, was receiving the newspaper. That's how they got their news. It was robust. It had the refrigerator journalism on it. And that was the industry. And, you know, and really, you know, from a standpoint of reach, you know, at our heyday, and it was before my time, but we probably reached 100,000 people. I mean, that was our circulation was probably around that. Well, now, you know, that information is being disseminated on social media. It's being disseminated in you know, the emails that Joe sends out. you know, all that information is reaching so many more people than it ever did back in the day. One of those misconceptions is, the newspaper's dead. Newspaper has never been more alive.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to end our talk here, but just real quick, I got to do this. Joe, what's your cat's name?
This one that keeps bothering us right here?
Yeah.
This one is actually called No-No because he's always getting into trouble.
Perfect. That is, well, I didn't want No-No to, you know, have all that screen time without getting acknowledged. And I think they know when they're on camera.
Right?
They've seemed to figure it out. Well, to both of you, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
That was the Slow Chambers, Jim D'Antona, speaking with Joe Tirica and Ray Reardon of the San Luis Obispo Tribune. And finally, KCBX contributor Brian Reynolds speaks with international author and filmmaker Helena Norberg Hodge. She's a pioneer of the local economy movement.
Today we are joined by Helena Norberg Hodge, best-selling author, filmmaker, linguist, environmentalist, and critic of the globalized economy, particularly for food production. For nearly 50 years, she has been promoting an economics of personal, social, and ecological well-being through her writing and public lectures on five continents. Born in Sweden, she was trained as a linguist. In 1975, she traveled to the region of Ladakh, an area in western Tibet claimed by India. This particular area had previously been sealed off from colonization or development. Although poor and lacking in certain resources such as winter fuel, she found the people of Ladakh among the happiest and healthiest she had ever seen. This experience strengthened her interest in localization efforts worldwide. Today, Helena Norberg Hodge joins us from her home in Byron Bay, Australia.
It seems to me that even though this approach is a return to the old or traditional ways, they are ways that have served humanity pretty well for millennia before they left the farm, they left the home workshop and became what was called in the 19th century wage slaves. So it's actually a return to the old ways, which worked for us for a long, long time. Is that correct?
Yes. The thing I would add, though, is that as the new local happens, it's very different from the older local communities that you might have experience, because what's happened is that because smaller towns, smaller businesses, farmers have been marginalized and sort of left behind, very often those local communities can feel a bit dead. You know, almost all the action has been in the mega cities and at the global level. And if you're not a global somebody, you are a nobody. So what's so wonderful about the new local is that it's actually created by people who have been to the big city, who have often traveled and seen what the options are in the world, and they realize that they value a connection to place, a sense of community, and living in a more human scale, human-paced way of life. So this is now happening because of a conscious choice, and most of the people who are leading it are open, tolerant. And also, I just want to add that it's so exciting to realize that in the really traditional forms of agriculture, which actually many indigenous people practice and many really ancient traditional communities, they never had the pressure of needing to increase diversity on the land. They didn't have any pressure to really increase productivity. So now with the new local, what's very exciting is we're finding that if you try to increase productivity on the land by increasing the number of species and even including animals in a cycle, you can increase productivity without destroying the land. And this is in direct contrast to what happened in the modern era, where using fossil fuels and the chemicals that came out of the war machine were used for pesticides, herbicides, chemical fertilizers on bigger and bigger monocultures. Those monocultures have never, ever produced more food per acre of land. They only produce more food per unit of human beings. In other words, they destroy jobs on the land and replace people with machines, also powered by fossil fuels, and then use all those chemicals, and turn the land into a dust bowl and into a situation where it's very difficult to produce food, and particularly if you want to do it in a healthy way. So maybe the most important message from the localization movement is, if we turn around the subsidies, regulations, and taxes to support small biodiverse farms linked to local markets, we can actually dramatically increase production while we dramatically reduce CO2 emissions, toxic pollution, and provide health for people and the environment. It's a really important message.
We're often so cynical or afraid or jaded these days that we don't think we can have win-win situations. But what I've just heard you describe is a win-win in this context, that we will have a traditional values and traditional ways of living and interacting with the land and the other creatures, but leavened and improved by modern lessons learned and modern technologies that allow us to avoid the mistakes of the near past. Is that a reasonable approach?
Absolutely, because communication and international collaboration are vital. And unfortunately, a lot of people get confused. They think localization is about closing off. What we're talking about is a worldwide localization movement where people are exchanging information, collaborating, and supporting each other. What we're up against is blindness, because our governments are just blindly wedded to the belief that increasing growth can only happen through increasing global trade and subsidizing and removing regulations for global corporations. In doing that, they're just creating a rat race that is a path of job insecurity, even for the giants. You know, Exxon wasn't big enough. You had to merge with Mobil, and then there's only one CEO job. So this path of globalizing means merging, getting bigger and bigger, fewer and fewer jobs, more and more technology, more robots. That economic path is a techno-economic path that is using more and more resources, polluting more and more, and destroying jobs. The other turn towards localizing, which is not an absolute, is not just about local, but it's about shortening distances, supporting genuine productivity on the land, whether in fisheries, forestry, or farming, and creating many more stable, meaningful livelihoods. It truly is a win-win-win. And people at the grassroots are waking up to it. In COVID, many people have actually started growing a bit of food for themselves. They've connected more with family and neighbors. We really need to wake up to the fact that it's the economic system that's driving us to just fight for our survival. Why all this time pressure and stress? It's entirely because of this mega techno-economic path that leaves human beings behind.
I would like to remind everyone, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Helena Norberg-Hodge, Director of Local Futures, author of Ancient Futures, producer of The Economics of Happiness, and pioneer of the worldwide localization movement. I think the global economy and capitalism unchained is based on a couple of huge falsehoods. One is that infinite growth that benefits everyone is possible or desirable, economic growth.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is, again, blindness. Our political leaders are not being forced to step back and look at the big picture. The truth is that in every country, the gap between rich and poor is widening so rapidly, so exponentially. Why is this happening? How is it happening? It's because the idea of growth, growing the economy, actually means that our governments are supporting this idea that the global multinationals are the only way to create growth. It's a complete myth. And if you look at the truth of it, it means that day by day, fewer people are winning. And we're talking about such a small number of winners now, where the 1% not even one, is sort of winning and amassing wealth, and 99% are left behind. So really what we need to do is for the 99% to become more economically literate. What we're talking about is not saying that nobody can earn more money than somebody else. So in that sense, capitalism could be fine, but it needs to be accountable, visible, and the voting citizen needs to have some idea what they're voting for.
I watched a YouTube video of you and Noam Chomsky, but he talked in an optimistic vein with you. It was that, yes, we do have big problems, but we also have big resources, especially since the 1960s, with some environmental consciousness and racial equity. Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely. I really feel that all around the world, most people now want to have healthier, cleaner water and healthier food. People want to have a secure livelihood, a roof over their head, and they want to have that sense of community and family and connection. Remember, that's probably the most important thing for people, to have a sense of being connected and to be valued and essentially to be loved. But as we're running and blindly in this direction of more and more competition, more and more insecurity, more and more fear, we must wake up to start saying, what's happening? We're calling this progress, but it's not really what people want. So I'm seeing not just the potential for people to be more kind and caring and have a healthy environment, but I'm actually seeing people starting to implement that from the grassroots. That's what this worldwide localization movement is about.
This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. We have been joined by Helena Norberg-Hodge, author of Local Futures and founder of the Globalization Movement for Localization. Thank you so much, Helena.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.